This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of the responses to the opioid epidemic has been an effort to document how the drugs are being prescribed and who is prescribing them.
Until we're able to identify who the abusers are that are prescribing, we can't really do anything on the enforcement end.
McLean County Assistant State's Attorney Adam Grist tells GLT's Judy Valente a spike in overdose deaths is partly the result of drugs being mixed. Get a preview of Central Illinois' first drone conference. Ryan Denham talks with a commercial drone pilot and founder of WomenAndDrones.com. And hear a spooky recording from beyond the grave captured by a Central Illinois ghost hunter. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's October 31st, 2017. Happy Halloween. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Health officials say about 140 people die of opioid overdoses in the U.S. every day. President Trump recently declared opioid addiction a public health emergency. And in McLean County, the number of overdose deaths nearly doubled in the past year to 23. The number of people still addicted remains elusive. Local and state officials are trying to get a handle on the scope of the problem, how to treat it, and prevent it in a conference tomorrow at the Chateau, hosted by the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority, and in another session from the U.S. Attorney's Office and the County Bar Association later this month. GLT's Judy Valente sat down with McLean County Sheriff, or former McLean County Sheriff Mike Emery, who is now with the U.S. Attorney's Office, Nathan Hinch of the Bar Association, and Adam Grist, First Assistant State's Attorney. Grist says the spike in overdose deaths is partly the result of drugs being mixed to form a lethal combination.
Drugs like fentanyl being mixed with heroin, what that does is it prevents overdose reversals from being successful, and therefore you have more deaths as a result of an opioid overdose. I don't think that's the only reason, but that's just one that I'm aware of.
Well, that type of mixing is illegal, if I understand it correctly.
Heroin,
Sheriff Emery.
Yeah, opioids and heroin, they mix. The relationship between the two is that a person that's not addicted to heroin can become addicted to opioids based on what type of injury they may have received the opioids for, the pain medication, and part of their pain management. Now, what happens and what we're seeing is the fact that the prescription opioids are being stopped, but yet now that the patient has the addiction and they're turning to heroin, which is, like Adam said, now being mixed with fentanyl. And if you don't know what fentanyl is, that can tranquilize a horse. We're also seeing carfentanil, which is powerful enough to tranquilize an elephant. And when you start mixing those three elements together, yes, there's going to be a devastating effect on the individual themselves.
Right, Nate Hinch, I see you shaking your head. Did you want to jump in?
Exactly. It starts as innocently as an injury or a surgery and just receiving prescription pain medication, but people don't realize how addictive it can be from the perfectly legitimate need for alleviating that pain can develop rapidly into an addiction where they need more, and then you get into excessive prescriptions or prescription medication abuse. And then when that runs out then and that channel is shut off, then the addiction is already so entrenched that then the person who might not otherwise have been drawn at all to illegal drugs then might turn to drugs like heroin and fentanyl.
Well, that begs the question of the role of physicians overprescribing some of these drugs, and yet they're not being prosecuted. The people selling the drugs on the street are being prosecuted. Do you want to address that, Adam?
One of the things that we're going to talk about at this summit is prescription. And with the recognition of this epidemic, there has been an increased move to legislate the communication between how drugs are prescribed and who is prescribing them. And with that increased communication and that increased documentation, we as a state can start to look at, okay, where are these drugs being most prescribed and who's abusing those? Because until we're able to identify who the abusers are that are prescribing, we can't really do anything on the enforcement end.
You talk about the almost doubling of the numbers of opioid deaths in our community. Who are these people who have died? Adam, could you address that?
I can tell you that of the 23 opioid deaths in 2017, one had an education of eighth grade or less, three didn't complete high school, eight were high school graduates, eight had some college level education, and three had a bachelor's degree. Two had military service completed, five were married, three were divorced, there was one widow, and 14 had never been married. I mean, it is an indiscriminate problem that goes across every bound of our community and our society.
Nate Hensch, these are the people that died, but there's a whole exponential group of people out there who may be addicted. What do we know about the numbers who are addicted?
Judy, back to the earlier questions, it's very easy to think, well, that's somebody else's problem. Because, you know, for those of us that consider ourselves healthy, and what Adam just said is that it's not just somebody else. It's potentially me. It's my colleagues in the Bar Association. The Bar is very aware of attorney drug abuse and alcohol abuse issues. And Sheriff Emery is pointing out to me here.
Go ahead, Sheriff Emery. Go ahead if you have the numbers.
From the statistics of the Illinois Department of Public Health, what we're looking at is male Caucasian between the age of 18 and 64.
That's a pretty wide age gap, though, 18 to 64.
It just shows you, as they mentioned earlier, this drug does not discriminate. It's not urban. It's also rural.
Mm-hmm.
What about women? I didn't hear you say anything about women, Sheriff Emery. Is it less of a problem among women?
Just by these statistics, Judith, it's about 50% difference. Male certainly outnumber female.
Did you want to add something, Nate Hensch?
And I just wanted to add on to that as the civil practice attorney that the other side of that is civil liability and pursuing what's being called big pharma.
Well, describe that for our listeners who might not know what you're talking about, the civil liability for big pharma. What does that all mean?
Given what we've talked about what's been going on in terms of abuse of prescription medication, and Judy, you mentioned what's the doctor's role in it. Well, there's also what's the pharmaceutical company's role that's producing these opioid medications. What did they know? What didn't they know in terms of how addictive it is and some of the repercussions that we're seeing? And should there be any civil liability, not necessarily separate from criminal, but should there be any civil liability for that? And we're seeing those types of lawsuits start popping up around the country.
Sheriff Emery, did you want to jump in on that?
Within our drug DEA division of the Department of Justice, they have a diversion unit that specifically looks at the industry, pharmaceuticals, the prescriptions, the doctors. They're the ones charged with the oversight of that. So on the local level, no, there's no way to control that. However, also at the conference will be a presentation by the director of the Prescription Monitoring Program, the PMP, which has recently taken on upgrades for the system. And also they're going to new legislation coming down to where doctors had a choice, those who prescribed the opioids had a choice whether or not to enter into that system and log it in. But every pharmacist in Illinois has that obligation to log in that information. So it'll be a very informative presentation by the state of Illinois Department of Public Health, which this whole conference was put together for awareness. And the information that's going to come out will certainly be utilized for operations or activities down the road from this.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with former Sheriff Mike Emery, now with the U.S. Attorney's Office for Central Illinois, and also Adam Grist, first Assistant State's Attorney for McLean County, and Nathan Hensch of the McLean County Bar Association, about the upcoming conference on heroin addiction and opioid drug abuse in McLean County. Nate Hensch, I want to ask you, Adam mentioned the timeliness of this conference here in McLean County, but this is an epidemic that's been going on for years. Why is it just getting a spotlight now in McLean County? Your Bar Association is co-sponsoring the event.
Yes. Well, and I think it's not just us. It's getting more of a spotlight nationally as well. So the problem has been, just anecdotally, for the past few years building, but it seems to be coming to a head more. And I'm not quite sure why it's taken that time personally. But I think in terms of what we're seeing here, it's just at a threshold, I guess I would say.
Sheriff Emery?
You know, and one other thought on that is the fact that it's coming to light now because we're starting to see where the prescription opioids are being reduced, but yet the people that are addicted to these opioids...
The prescriptions are being reduced.
Prescriptions are being reduced, but those that now have the opioid addiction have no avenue, and a lot of times there's no pain management or treatment facility for them to go. So now they turn to heroin, and they overdose, and then it's backtracked to how do they get to that point. And as you start looking at those numbers, I mean, there is a town in Virginia, population 5,000, but yet in 1 year, they distributed over 9 million opioids in a town of 5,000 people. So you see where that the opioids have built up, and then they're being reduced. People are turning to heroin and overdosing.
To one of your earlier questions, we've attacked this problem for, like you do a lot of problems, in reverse. 5 years ago, we recognized that we were having, when I was a drug prosecutor, we recognized that we had an increase in heroin coming into McLean County. And we talked about ways to address and deal with that from a law enforcement perspective. And we had to work the problem backwards to realize the fact that our high school kids were becoming addicted to opioids because of sports injuries. And we were seeing that increase in heroin usage as time went on. So we had to work it backwards.
Adam, you mentioned we've gone about the solution for this from a law enforcement perspective, but your conference that's coming up is going to talk about treatment options as well. What can you tell us about that? Nate, would you like to address that?
Sure. As we were planning this program, we talked about three main perspectives, the law enforcement perspective, the treatment, the medical perspective, and then the rehabilitation perspective as well, and wanting to make sure that we addressed all three of those areas. So we'll have expert speakers from McLean County as well as from around the state come.
What from your own experience do you feel we could do better in the treatment area? Who would like to address that? Adam?
I don't know that I'm capable of addressing that, because, you know, my experience is limited. And that's one of the reasons I'm so excited about this summit, is that after this summit, I might be better able to answer that question. We have very well-trained people in the treatment field coming and talking with folks, and they're going to talk with doctors, and they're going to talk with a pharmacist. Hopefully, they're going to talk with, you know, we'd love to have some dentists come. If you're a doctor or a dentist and you're listening to this, we'll give you the number. Call us. Come to our summit. If you're a pharmacist, come to our summit. But the whole point of this is to get everybody in the same room, to get everybody listening to the different aspects of this problem so that we can communicate better.
Sheriff Emery, you wanted to address that?
Judith, I was just going to say, if you think back when we were dealing with the mental health issue, lack of affordable housing, addictions, with the jail, and how that played out into the community when the National Institute of Corrections came in and did an assessment, and how McLean County and leaders from Bloomington Normal and other disciplines came together to collaborate, communicate, and cooperate to address this issue. You're starting to see the results of that effort with the mental health facility being built at the jail for, you know, inmates that have mental health illnesses, proper housing. You saw a private facility and government join forces to look at an addiction center on the west side of Bloomington, Chestnut. So this effort here is going to take the same amount of commitment from a lot of the same individuals to address this. But to touch on what Adam just mentioned about the treatment part of it, is this community in a position that has enough treatment beds, addiction centers?
Is it, in your view?
Well, I think they make a good effort on that, but this is something else that needs to be addressed by all the people that Nate just mentioned that's going to be in attendance here at this conference. Is our community, is your county capable of people with an addiction having access to that treatment?
Adam, did you want to add something?
Well, I know from Joan Hartman at Chestnut Health Systems, they have a great facility, and that just one example is my understanding in the last 3 months, they have not gone 24 hours while being at capacity for bed space. And that's something I know because the current sheriff, John Sandage, and I are talking with her about starting a Safe Passages program here in McLean County. It's something a lot of counties do where law enforcement can use their discretion and usher people into a treatment path instead of a
As opposed to putting them in jail.
Right.
Go ahead, Nate.
I was just going to add that part of the challenge and the reason why this a program like this is so important is because it's so complex, lots of different experts from all these different perspectives to be in the same room sharing what they're seeing and their experience, you know, what's going on and what the ER doc is seeing, you know, what Chestnut is seeing and what the sheriff is seeing, to get those different points of view to come at the problem from all different sides as opposed to just, you know, my silo.
Your conference has a section on communication. And what did you mean by that? What type of communication needs to be better? What type of collaboration needs to be better, Sheriff Emery?
Judith, the way that was designed was everybody within their own little discipline, it's certainly communicating about this epidemic. But are they communicating outside of their discipline? Educators are talking to educators, doctors to doctors, lawyers to lawyers, treatment center to treatment center. But are we all sitting down at the same table and communicating what we're seeing and sharing our information? Because what I may say could help Dr. Adam over here or help Nate with what they're trying to do. And if we're duplicating our services, why are we doing that? Let's collaborate, come together, share our resources, and have a larger positive impact on our community as opposed to try to go along and be an individual about it. So that's what the part of the communication is, continue the conversation. We had two of these conversations in Sangamon County, April 13th, I believe, and June 27th, and both were packed. And it also included the private sector, you know, because the private sector is a big part of our community. And if we can all sit down, just like with the mental health issue, if everybody sits down that needs to sit down, the leadership sit down at the table, we're going to solve a lot more problems together.
There may not be many houses on many blocks in our community that don't have these opioids in their houses. You have to recognize that. I know our family, for one, my wife went through an operation last year and had a very long and difficult, painful recovery. She was prescribed a couple of different opioids. Each one of our law enforcement agencies, Normal Police Department, Bloomington Police Department, and the Sheriff's Department, have a location that you can bring those unused opioids to those places and get rid of them. Would encourage people to do that because the fewer opportunities people have to get and take those drugs are the fewer opportunities we have to be victim to them.
Nate Hinch, final word.
I think a word of encouragement to those out there listening to this. You know, when we say that this could be anyone, hopefully that hits home as if you listening to this have been having issues with prescription medication and feeling like you can't let it go, and maybe you're addicted, don't be ashamed of it. Get help. It could happen. It literally could happen to anyone. It's not just because somebody's particularly weak or susceptible or anything. You know, it's the strong athletes potentially, you know, or the highly educated professionals, you know, in stressful jobs that are facing this and might not have thought of themselves as being susceptible to an addiction like that. So it's not necessarily anything about you if you're faced with this.
Thank you all for coming in. Mike Emery, the former sheriff of McLean County, now the law enforcement coordinator for the U.S. Attorney's Office for Central Illinois. Adam Grist, who is the first assistant state's attorney here in McLean County. And Nathan Hinch with Mueller, Reese & Hinch, also a member of the McLean County Bar Association, talking about the epidemic of heroin addiction and opioid drug abuse conference coming up. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
And the Addiction and Opioid Drug Abuse Summit is Tuesday, November 14th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Bone Student Center Circus Room at Illinois State University. It's co-sponsored by the McLean County Bar Association and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District of Illinois. It's Sound Ideas on GLT.
support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The drone industry is growing rapidly, threatening to disrupt many different industries from agriculture to photography to shipping. The research firm Gartner projects 3 million drones will be produced for personal and commercial use this year. That's a 39% increase from 2016. That means more amateurs and businesses launching their own unmanned aircraft and more questions about how to use them. To answer some of those questions, Heartland Community College will host what's being billed as Central Illinois' first drone conference November 10th. The keynote speaker is Sharon Rossmark, an ISU graduate who retired from a senior leadership position at Allstate. She's since earned her commercial drones pilot license and founded the organization WomenAndDrones.com. She talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about what sparked her passion for drones.
It's interesting how life takes its twists and turns. I'm actually fascinated by the potential of the flying robot, and my first exposure to it was actually there at Illinois State University, and having an opportunity to see it in action on the campus there at a classroom presentation by some students. I knew then that my love for flight had just been connected with the flying robot. And so it was a great opportunity to marry the two. So while education and life took me in a different direction, I ended up on this journey, and it's been a fascinating flight.
What is it about drones and unmanned aircraft that you find so fascinating, that it's become more than just a hobby for you?
Well, I can tell that you have not flown one. Otherwise, you would know. It's just something about the opportunity to be a part of aviation. It's hard to describe until you try it. And not the bug doesn't bite everybody, but if you're fascinated about aviation and have any interest in flying robots, or even working in an industry that's emerging, it's a great place to be.
So you founded the organization called Women in Drones. Can you tell me about that group and what you do?
So the purpose of Women in Drones and its mission is to raise the profile and visibility of women in the industry. Our daily focus is on disseminating positive images of women that are in the industry and demonstrating how women are major contributors to the economic pulse of this emerging global ecosystem. It has evolved to become now more where we often get asked inquiries in terms of how to get into the industry, ask for services. And so it's been a great opportunity to just explode and focus on a very unique niche.
And so women are traditionally underrepresented in many technology fields. Is that the same for the unmanned aircraft industry?
It is the same. However, the numbers are trending along the same line as it is for manned aircraft aviation. And so about 4% of the women in manned aircraft aviation are commercial pilots. And we're seeing a similar trend on the commercial pilot side for drones, and that's information that's tracked by the FAA.
It seems like you've hit that critical mass now where you can pretty much buy a simple unmanned aircraft or drone at Walmart or Toys R Us. Obviously, that's not a very high-end item, but it's there, right? It's staring you in the face on store shelves. It seems like it's really taken off, and I'm just kind of curious as to what your thoughts are on the overall trajectory of the drone industry and kind of where you see it today.
To start off with, you're absolutely right on point that you can basically buy your drone off the shelf of any common commercial retail store. And what we're finding is that people of all ages are fascinated and interested in the drone technology and its capabilities. If you think about where we were just a few short years ago with the phone, and how basically it was to talk on, and then it became a camera. The drones are, from a trending standpoint, are even ahead of the curve in terms of not only its capability, but where the market has taken it. So you've probably heard about package delivery. You may have even heard about passenger drones. So, if you think about to the cartoon The Jetsons, I may be aging myself. But all of that's a reality in the very near future because of the capability and where the direction is going. Because the technology is there, it's really more around having the regulations align, and the FAA is working very hard to align regulations with the capabilities of the technology.
Where do things stand now from a regulatory standpoint with drones? Can you talk about commercial users and the amateurs who are out there? Does any kind of framework exist at this point, or are we still kind of finding our way on it?
No, there is a framework for commercial operators. There is a certification process that if you want to fly commercially, and when I say fly commercially, I want to make sure I'm clear on that. That is defined as receiving compensation of any sort to fly a drone. There is a required licensing, or what they call a certification, issued by the FAA. The testing for that is very similar, because the nature of the questions follow in line with the questions that you find on a manned aircraft test for pilots. Because it's important to understand that once you lift that drone off the ground, regardless if it's a toy drone or one that you plan on flying commercially, you're flying in a national airspace. So to answer your question about the regulations, are in place specifically for commercial operators in terms of not only the certification, but then rules and regs that you have to follow in order to fly.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Sharon Rossmark, who is the keynote speaker at the Drones Conference coming up November 10th at Heartland Community College. The use of drones in military conflict is pretty well documented. A lot of folks will probably be familiar with that idea, at least. Can you talk about some of the ethical concerns about drone use here on American soil, you know, when it comes to law enforcement who might be using them, just general privacy concerns with amateur use? What kinds of things have you heard about?
Well, the concerns are there. The concerns are legitimate. There are no federal regulation for drone operators in terms of privacy. However, what you're finding is more and more local markets, municipalities are developing regulation around it, or rules, or maybe even laws associated with flying drones. The privacy is probably one that is the most concerned, but I got to tell you, my experience with drone operators is that generally you have a hobbyist, so someone that's not flying commercial. They've purchased a drone, they've opened up the box and want to put it up in the sky, which is not the direction to go, but that's generally what people do. And they're probably either losing control of it, or they're just trying to get a feel for how to control it or practice with it. And they end up flying over the neighbor's house or in their yard or over people, which is against the rules. You're not supposed to fly over groups of people. So to answer your question, the rules and regulations are there. Hobbyists tend to not understand them or know what they are. Privacy is a major concern. As you indicated, the military has been using drones, the large drones, for any number of years. I still hear quite a bit of it, how it's being used in war zones. So from a local standpoint, it's really up to the local municipalities to kind of get their arms around the privacy issue.
So you're the keynote speaker at an upcoming conference at Heartland Community College here in Normal on November 10th. It's called Drones, Disruptions, Opportunities in the Future. You've spoken at aviation and drone conferences in the past. So I'm kind of curious, what do people get out of these conferences from what you've seen?
Well, I think that what you'll find is that you'll find a combination of those hobbyists who come in to learn about what's the direction of the industry, what are the newest products on the market, as well as just to really hear about what are the opportunities. From the commercial operator standpoint, they're always looking for opportunities to learn about how to improve marketing, as well as connect and network and talk with others that are in the industry, because a lot of the drone companies are small independent operators, so this is their opportunity to network with one another.
So what's going to be the message you tried to deliver as keynote speaker at this drones conference coming up at Heartland?
Well, they've asked me to talk about exactly what the title is. They've asked me to talk about drones, the disruption it's causing in the marketplace, the opportunities that are available, and what I see in the future. So exactly as the title is exactly what they've asked me to speak about.
What's one of the disruptions?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should ask that, because I'm describing disruption as a positive, and it's really about those industries that are impacted in terms of making changes or the use of drones. So whether it's insurance companies, agriculture, utilities, mining, humanitarian, public safety, construction, all, you know, any number of industries are feeling the impact in a very positive way, because what happens is you can use drones for to do the dirty work, or the work that is puts life in jeopardy. You can imagine having to climb a utility pole. Well, if you can send a drone up, you have a safety opportunity there for life save or injury from an employee standpoint. In a humanitarian standpoint, you may have seen drones most recently being used in the hurricanes down in Texas and Florida for humanitarian relief. So it's any number of areas from a disruption standpoint, but I look at the disruption as a positive.
That's Sharon Rossmark, who's the keynote speaker at the Drones Conference coming up November 10th at Heartland Community College. I'm Ryan Denham.
The November 10th conference at Heartland will include demos and presentations by national and local drone experts representing agriculture, insurance, education, communications, the FAA, and more. It's Sound Ideas on 89FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Coming up, it's a report on a primary challenger to Governor Bruce Rauner. That story's on the way during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The fallout from the Harvey Weinstein scandal is now touching the Illinois State House. Last week, women lawmakers released a letter alleging a culture of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, perhaps even sexual assault in and around the General Assembly. That's the subject of this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable with Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune and Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield. The moderator is Brian Mackey.
The letter did not name names, but it did mention, in sort of general ways, this idea of a caucus leader who had taken somebody out to dinner and, you know, told them about his open marriage and asked about their relationship status. We've had a woman who's a lobbyist for the Sierra Club was quoted in a Washington publication about her own experiences of having her hair pulled and just kind of a miserable encounters with people in trying to do her job. Monique, the speaker was pretty swift in his reaction to this week.
Right. The day after this letter became public, the speaker issued a statement saying that this is unacceptable, but acknowledging that this is a culture that can thrive in silence here in Springfield. And he introduced some legislation that would require sexual harassment training for government officials. That includes lawmakers and statewide office holders. He'd also require lobbyists to develop their own sexual harassment training programs, and those who don't comply would be published in a list. And so there's going to be a hearing on this subject in Chicago. But I think that the larger question for a lot of women who've shared these stories in back halls or in elevators among other women is long-term, what kind of changes they'll see. The Daily Line had an interesting story that noted that the legislative inspector general, the person who would be in charge of investigating sexual harassment claims, there hasn't been anybody in that office, even though it's funded. So this is really about kind of where this will lead and if it will change behavior and culture in Springfield long term.
It's interesting you point that out in the Daily Line story, because something I read in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal is, you know, your first question when if a woman tells you about this should not be, well, did you report it? The question has to be, was there a way for you to safely report this, right? And there's a definite power dynamic. And in Springfield, you know, there are a lot of people that you don't want to irritate if you want to keep lobbying them and advancing.
Right. And these are the stories that women are trying to bring attention to, and that, you know, in a lot of instances, it would be perhaps a female lobbyist who is talking to a lawmaker who would have to support her bill. And he makes a comment about her appearance or her body. And there are these kind of, you know, not always overt conversations that are happening where women really feel that their power has been silenced, that their voices have been silenced. And so they're really hoping to just kind of bring attention and awareness. And they've made very clear that they're not naming names yet. But we have seen that happen in some other states. In California, there's been an investigation launched in a few other states where people have named names. So I think that this is a story that is far from over, and we'll probably be hearing more about it.
Yeah, and as I recall, the reason that they're not naming names is to highlight the fact that it's not one or two individuals that, you know, men, somebody like me could point the finger and say, oh, that's so-and-so, what a rat he is, and absolve myself of any blame for not being more vigilant, not speaking out, not doing what I could to prevent this kind of culture from flourishing. It's to get across the notion that this is so pervasive, it's not limited to one or two instances. It's universal. Virtually all women who've been involved with the legislature have experienced this in one form or another, and we have to put a stop to it.
And that's a good point, because some of the women that I've talked to this week since this letter came out said that they're really going back and kind of doing some soul searching and realizing that encounters that they just dismissed or instances where they just kind of laughed off an inappropriate comment, that this was so common that they didn't even realize perhaps that it should fall into the category of sexual harassment, and that it's just kind of something that women deal with every day, where you try to deflect, you try to tamp down a situation instead of raising your voice and saying, I'm done. And women around here are saying, I'm done, I'm sick, I'm not taking it anymore.
Monique Garcia is with the Chicago Tribune. Charlie Wheeler with the University of Illinois at Springfield, and Brian Mackey moderated the Illinois Politics Roundtable. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. State Representative Jeannie Ives says she's taking on Governor Bruce Rauner in the upcoming Republican primary. The former Wheaton City Councilwoman and West Point graduate acknowledges it will be tough going up against Rauner's vast personal wealth. But she says the governor has betrayed Republican principles and wants to give voters a choice. Ives spoke with IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey.
Why do you want to be governor?
Well, because I've been down in Springfield for 5 years now, and I know that the last people that are considered before votes are taken and bills are passed are the families and the businesses. They're getting lied to, and they're getting hurt by the politics in Springfield, and that's why I need to run for governor.
Who is lying to the taxpayers and businesses and the people of Illinois?
Well, let's take one example, because this happens all the time. The education bill that was passed at the end of August is actually making a promise that we cannot keep to the taxpayers of the state of Illinois. So when you promise things and you can't deliver them, and you know that you're bankrupt and you can't deliver them, that's basically you're lying to people about you're going to change education policy.
I'm curious, why do you think there is this culture of lying to taxpayers, as you say?
Well, because they've been able to get away with it. You know, there's not a single Democrat state rep or state senator that has a passing grade when their votes are rated by business associations. Not a single one of them. But they will walk into a Chamber of Commerce event in their own community, and they will try to tell people how pro-business they are. And that's a lie. Because the same associations that look at their votes, know what bills they have put up, and know how they have voted on business bills, have said the opposite. And at the end of session this year, you had the major business groups come together in a press conference and say, business got nothing this session. Nothing. And in fact, it got hurt. If you don't have businesses, you don't have families that can make it in this state anymore. This is about keeping people that have committed their lives to Illinois, have improved their communities through their own services with not-for-profits, and they can't make it anymore. That's the problem in Illinois.
I wonder, though, that message, I've heard something similar from Governor Rauner about we need to be focusing on business and improve the business climate in Illinois. And I think some people might hear about your candidacy and say, well, we already have a Republican governor. How would you be different?
Well, you know, Governor Rauner has actually bought into some of the same policies that has hurt Illinois in the past. His energy bailout bill in December basically gave carve-outs and favored status to a company that is, you know, had a $2.25 billion net profit. Who's saying that that's going to help the average Illinoisan when you're just going to raise the price for ratepayers to a favored company? That's the type of stuff that needs to stop. He signed a brand new entitlement program when the state is bankrupt that most Illinoisans disagree with, either for financial reasons or both financial and social reasons. So that's not helping anybody. That's not being honest with folks, especially when you told people you're going to veto it.
Are you worried about creating a civil war within the Illinois Republican Party?
Look, Governor Rauner is the one who has created the civil war in the Republican Party, not Jeannie Ives. So, look, people were willing to go along with him until he absolutely violated every principle that is core to the Republican Party. So, you know, he's done this to himself. He's obviously maybe not interested in the job anymore, quite frankly. He seems a little bit distant and disinterested. And him riding alone on a motorcycle in a campaign ad pretty much tells you that he is a loner.
State Representative Jeannie Ives speaking with IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey. The Rauner campaign was asked if it wanted to respond to Ives' comments. Spokesman Justin Giorgio emailed a statement that reads, "Governor Rauner is focused on fighting for Illinois' future and defeating Mike Madigan's machine so Illinois can have property tax relief and term limits, and so we can roll back the Madigan income tax hike." You're listening to Sound Ideas.
This week in This American Life. If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what are you kidding me?
A car dealership in Long Island tries to sell its monthly quota of cars, 129 cars. It's not going well.
I want balloons in the showroom. I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Will it work? Find out. Listen Saturday at noon on GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Halloween is a day for all things spooky, but for one Bloomington Normal man, any day can be spooky. That's because Eric Vogel hears dead people, and you can too. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Some people play golf for a hobby. Others like baking or drawing or just hanging out on Facebook. Not Eric Vogel. His hobby is spent in pursuit of ghosts, recording them as electronic voice phenomenon, or EVP. That's voices or noises that are picked up on a digital recorder that can't be heard with the naked ear. Vogel says the paranormal has always intrigued him.
Most people that get into this had an experience at one point or time in their life, and that was not the case with me. I just really enjoyed kind of reading stories, and I'm a big history person, so a lot of these places have a lot of history tied to them. So I just kind of lucked upon a tour group here in town that used to do investigations at the Mid-City Hotel.
The Spirits of Bloomington tour?
Yes.
Yes.
So they used to do investigations at the Mid-City Hotel, which a lot of people are unaware of, is right next to the bistro, starting on the second floor. So I did some investigations with them and used just an old digital recorder and was able to capture some EVPs. And from there, I started working with them for a while.
What did you capture?
Being my first time that I ever did an investigation, I really didn't know what to expect. It was a little crowded. They had a group of about 20 or so. So there's some background noise of people chatting and stuff. But I captured a female voice humming, like almost like she was holding a baby and kind of comforting it. And I also captured a gentleman whistling.
The chain behind us just moved.
Shut up, Eric.
No, I swear.
I can't even hear things like that.
No, I swear to God.
How did you know it was a guy whistling?
The person that was doing the tours with us claimed to be a psychic. And after the investigation further down the line, I told her what I captured, and she said there was a gentleman that had lived, and it was in the residence of the people that ran the hotel, that he was a musician.
So hence the whistling.
Yes.
What are you looking for, Eric, doing this sort of thing? Are you trying to establish the fact that there are ghosts out there, that we can record them, that this is a way to prove the existence of spirits?
It's more of just a hobby for me. I like going to places, kind of settling in and getting a sense of what it might have been like to live there, whether it was a hospital or somebody's older home. There's a misconception, I think, that when people think of ghosts, they think of something evil. And that isn't necessarily the case. I think that there's this energy that might still be left in some of these locations. And it could be happy energy. One house that I actually stayed in, dog watching, that I ended up doing an investigation on, the dogs woke up in the middle of the night and they were feet up on the baby crate, and I saw their heads kind of going back and forth, and I heard the pitter-patter of feet running back and forth.
So maybe there was a young spirit in the house?
There was two kid spirits there from what, when I brought psychic with eventually. And
she, so you brought a psychic mm-hmm. over?
She stepped out of the car and she looked at me and she goes, yes, there's some spirits here.
Tell me about the equipment that you use in order to do this. The first time you went there, you used digital recording.
Yeah, I just used a regular little Sony, you know, what you'd use like in an interview kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I upgraded to just a more four-channel recording device. It's a H2 recorder, digital recorder. And I also utilize like a digital thermometer, infrared thermometer, and a device called a K2 meter, which is measures electronic magnetic fields. And these all kind of can come into play when determining whether there's a cold spot where there might be something trying to manifest itself to something interacting with you on the K2 meter.
Just speculating now, this energy that could be remaining that you say that you're recording, is this energy with consciousness, or is this energy that is almost like an energy rerun that keeps playing over and over and over again?
There's both. I think that there is the kind of record player effect where you might hear a noise or like the pitter-patter of feet that I talked about, you know, that could be something that just replays itself over. Some of the things that I have captured over time are direct answers to questions, which once you listen to them and you realize that you are standing right there and something gives you a direct response, it kind of gives you goosebumps.
So let's give a listen to an example of that.
Are you not too sure about us right now?
So tell us more about what you heard in this recording, Eric. Where was this? What was going on?
This, if you recall, the old warehouses that kind of fell in off of Main Street a few years ago, it was it's called the Glass House. It was a glass manufacturing company, mm-hmm. And it was by a kiln, and it was firing, and so you hear kind of the kiln going, and there's some people talking in the background, and the psychic that was with us, there was what she called Big Boss Man that was roaming around. And it used to be a child factory, apparently.
So they had child labor there.
Yep. And all the kid spirits were still there, and the Big Boss Man would not let them go. So she and another person that was with us stood outside, opened up the big bay doors, and they just yelled, "Ollie, Ollie, Oxenfree." And this huge gust of wind just flew out. And both of the ladies just started crying. So I went back in afterwards, and you hear the question, and I get a direct response to it.
Have you ever come up across anything that really scared you, Eric?
Most recently, I did an investigation in Ashmore Estates, which is down in Ashmore, Illinois, by Eastern Illinois. It was a poor folks' home for a while back in the early 1900s, and then became a private psych hospital up until about 1986. And there's a lot of activity there where it was the first time that I've seen black masses. I had a rock thrown at me, which you will hear.
It started at the bottom.
Oh, we're okay. You're okay. Dude, I am so goosebumped right now.
So as someone who works with sound for a living, I'm just wondering about some other things that could be happening that can be confused for spirit voices and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. There might be other natural explanations, yep. such as picking up on radio interference, CBs, baby monitors yep. as well. Do you experience that, and could this possibly be what we're hearing?
I look at everything with an eye that it's fake.
So you go in skeptical.
Yeah, I do. And I've gone into places that, you know, people claim are haunted, and sometimes the spirits just aren't active. Other times I will listen to 6 hours of audio and get nothing. It could be, as you said, baby monitor. It could be a car door slamming that you might hear. It could be somebody walking up the stairs that's a neighbor. You try to debunk, because a lot of people scrutinize, you know, to the point of saying you're a kook or something, believing in something like this.
It's a very human thing, I think, when you hear something, the brain sometimes incorrectly interprets random patterns as being familiar patterns because the brain wants to make it something understandable.
Right. You know, I have several examples where I played for some other people and they came up with a different thing just based upon the pattern that it very well could be. There is a definite underlying sound that you hear that, knowing at the time where I was, it could be nothing else.
Eric, what do you say to folks who say, you know, this is the bunk, you know, this can't possibly be spirit voices, you're just projecting, or you're just picking up random sounds and you're just wanting them to be ghosts? How do you answer people like that?
Everybody's got an opinion. If your belief is that, if you're not open-minded enough to think that there is a possibility of something else is out there, that's your opinion. I'm not going to be able to change that. You know, it's a blind belief, like a lot of things that we have in life. Until you have an experience where you've been touched or you've had something thrown at you when nobody else is in the room in front of you, you know, kind of to each his own.
That's Eric Vogel. And he says you don't need fancy equipment in order to record electronic voice phenomena. Vogel says any cell phone can do the job. I'm Laura Kennedy.
As for all of the reality TV shows that depict real-life Ghostbusters in pursuit of supernatural audio and video, Vogel thinks that, with the exception of the Ghost Hunters, those shows are strictly for entertainment and should be viewed with skepticism. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas at WGLT and WGLT.org. Let us know what you think of the show. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.